Tim O'Brien is one of the most brilliant chroniclers of the Vietnam generation, a novelist whose work defined the war and the dark infusion into modern life which became its legacy. His 1979 novel, Going After Cacciato, won the National Book Award. In 1990, his novel, The Things They Carried, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. O'Brien has also written numerous novels which wind through the anomie of modern life. In the book In the Lake of the Woods, a couple vanish. Perhaps he killed her, perhaps not. O'Brien's new novel, July, July, brings together 30 years of time between the graduation of the class of 69 at a Minnesota college he calls Darton Hall, but the reunion, set in 2000, is a year late because the class secretary had a nervous breakdown. It has a cast of characters as large as a Greek chorus, but each voice sings out truly and deeply of love, promise, betrayal, and self-betrayal, a symphony of American life. Tim O'Brien joins us now. Tim O'Brien, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, as a novelist, I can think of nothing more fraught with peril than this well-worn path of the college reunion, something that is so often set up as a literary cliche. Why did you choose that frame?
Reunions of any sort, family or otherwise, serve as a kind of plateau from which one can survey the past, but also the future. Taking stock of one's life, one's mistakes, disappointments, joys.
It's a boozy, drug-infused, really hot reunion, literally. I mean, it's set in July because it was the only time they could get. Why don't you introduce us to this class of 69 at Darton Hall?
Sure. The reunion dance had started only an hour ago, but already a good many of the dancers were tipsy, and most others were well along. And now the gossip was flowing and confessions were underway and old flames were being extinguished and rekindled under cardboard stars in the Darton Hall College gymnasium. Amy Robinson was telling Jan Huebner, a former roommate, about the murder last year of Karen Burns, another former roommate. "It's such a Karen sort of thing," Amy said, "getting killed like that. Nobody else, only Karen." Amy made a weary, dispirited movement with her shoulders. "Nothing new, I'm afraid," she said. "Same old Karen story. Naive as a Valentine. Trust the world. Get squished."
These people's stories are very American. I mean, they're not particularly exotic stories, but they are riveting. And for a novelist who has not always written with a lot of female voices, you have some amazing ones here. There are at least eight different women that we learn about. My favorite was Spook Spinelli. First of all, I love her name.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us about Spook. She's a pretty inspired character, too. I was really interested in this twice-married conception you have for her.
Spook, for me, was a fun character to write. In fact, all the female characters were both challenging and really fun for a writer to try something different. In Spook's case, she's married to two different fellows. They seem to accept it, go along with it, more or less. And yet, she comes to the reunion alone, looking for zest and to recapture something from those years past when I suppose all of us, in one way or another, were filled with grand ideals and probably grand illusions, too.
And she falls for a guy called Marv Bertel, who's a successful mop salesman and fat. And he invents a deception that's just fantastic.
He does. Marv, each of the little stories about each of these characters is meant to be a kind of fulcrum or pivot in that character's life, so we learn something about who these people are. And in Marv's case, he made the mistake one day of losing a whole bunch of weight, which isn't a mistake, but then trying to make up a personality to accompany his svelte new body. And he tells a terrible lie to a woman that he's, in fact, a writer and not a mop and broom man, and then sustains that lie over the course of the next 12 to 18 pages of the book, and is finally discovered. And I don't know, this comes out of something that actually had happened to me personally, where someone pretended to be Tim O'Brien. And I tried writing about it from the victim's viewpoint and my viewpoint. But finally, when I began writing about it from the viewpoint of the person who had told the lie, it became interesting to me. And I thought it was something that people could identify with and laugh at a bit. But also, I found myself developing at least a little sympathy for the man.
Do you think that the characters in here constitute, well, they're sort of a collection of liberation and perhaps self-reconciliation. Pick someone who you think is the most liberated from this ensemble.
Well, I can tell you the character, I think, who becomes most liberated in the course of the book. There's a character whose name is Dorothy Steer, who both in college and through her adult life was kind of a country club, Republican, conservative, take no chances, no risk marriage kind of woman, who in the course of both her life and the reunion, really, I think, I came to love. I'm not a country club sort of man myself. And yet, when I began writing about Dorothy's breast cancer and her kind of dreamy looking back, how would things have been different if I'd taken a different course back in 1969? How would my life have been different if I'd married another man, if I'd run away to Canada in the course of the war with a fellow? I began to find myself liking her and sympathizing with her. And for me, that is a first as a novelist. I usually love my characters from, you know, point A to point Z.
There's a fantastic scene where she confronts her husband after her mastectomy, which is just great.
Right. It seems to me that one of the most fun to read and to write scenes in the whole book was a day when Dorothy Steer, 9 months after her radical mastectomy, has had enough of her husband's standoffish attitude toward her. He won't go near her sexually. He's afraid to touch her. He's afraid even to look at her. And one Saturday morning, as he's washing his car outside, Dorothy drinks a couple of vodka lemonades, marches down the driveway with her shirt off, and says to him, "Touch me. Look at me. Let's deal with this."
Your epitaph for this book is a couple of lines of William Butler Yeats's poetry. This line: "We had all fed the heart on fantasies. The heart's grown brutal from the fair." Is that the through line for the class of 69, Darton Hall?
I think in many ways, yes. I think in many ways it's the through line for all of us, that there's a light and there's a dark side to fantasy. The dark side, of course, is that fantasy can become compulsive. You know, if only I had more money, if only I were prettier, if only I were skinnier. And that can make for trouble in human life. But there's also a bright hemisphere to this fantasy business, which we need it as human beings to imagine a happier tomorrow, to keep plodding onward in our lives, thinking that, yeah, the day was pretty grim. Well, maybe tomorrow I'll find that man I need, or maybe tomorrow I'll do something about this weight problem of mine. And I don't know. It just seems to me that fantasy plays such a role in our lives. We underrate its importance. We dream dreams and try to march boldly into them.
Tim O'Brien, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Author Tim O'Brien. His new novel is called July, July.